So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, The Sun lifts its paywall, but in the new world of ad blockers, what hope is there for ad-funded journalism? The latest rate jars are out. We take a look around the country at the state of UK radio and why Radio 1 should focus on being a radio station first. Plus, more on the threat to freedom of information requests, Vice plans a free-to-air channel in the UK, and of course, our world-famous media quiz. That's all coming up on today's Fully Funded For Now, but keep the donations coming in, thank you very much, Media Podcast. And joining us today in the fine surroundings of the Hospital Club, it is the MD of content company Something Else, Mr. Steve Ackerman. Hello, Steve.
Good afternoon, Ollie.
You've been working on something suitably ghoulish for this Halloween weekend.
Are you talking about the Radio 4 drama? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I was talking about you going around trick-or-treating on every radio commissioner's door. Yes, no, I was talking about your Radio 4 drama, yes.
Yes.
I was giving you an opportunity to plug.
Oh, okay, that's very kind. It's a binaural drama for Radio 4 called The Stone Tape, directed by Peter Strickland, if you know Peter Strickland, sort of famous film director. So if you listen to it with your headphones on, it will freak you out.
That sounds like a promise worth exploring. Okay. And making her return to the show, it is the journalist known as the Fleet Street Fox, Ms. Susie Boniface.
Miss.
I'm saying Ms. What do you
miss.
Prefer? You prefer miss. Miss. I should have asked first.
I'm notoriously unmarried. I think that's fine. Miss, thank you.
Notoriously unmarried.
I always think Ms. is for something people who can't be bothered to find out whether someone's Mrs. or Miss or anything else.
It's
one of those things that councils use to send letters to people because they can't be asked to ask a polite question. And as a journalist, I find it appalling.
I know. I feel suitably chastised.
That's fantastic. A rant within the first 1 minute of the podcast.
I think notoriously unmarried sounds like a good slogan for any tabloid column, though.
It's on my business card.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you write for The Mirror, mainly.
Yes.
How have you been enjoying Jeremy Corbyn's rise to the top?
Well, you know, if he does well and he can be elected, then it must be for the good. But I think the sophology, the electoral maths, is against him actually being able to take power, because the way the last election worked means Labour really has to win over lots of English seats like Coventry and Plymouth and places like that, and I don't think he's got that kind of mass appeal.
Okay.
He has got a few years at it, but I can't see it happening. So okay. As a result, I think it's bad.
This isn't the place for serious electoral
Sorry.
Analysis. I preferred it when you just did the groan, because I think, you know, just we could all interpret
it. You did
ask. Now, you've got a book out as well. Not that it's the reason you're here.
I've got another book out this week, soon, yeah, for time for Christmas.
Tell us all
Second
about
book.
It.
It's The Bluffer's Ms. Guide Politics. To Social Media.
Uh-huh.
And it's just one of those sort of small stocking filler things, like, you know, they get The Bluffer's Guide to Wine and The Bluffer's Guide to Sex and things. It makes you sound like an expert in something that you might not actually be an expert in, and if you think you are an expert, you might learn some things that are quite useful. So there's lots of things in there about how to outrun a Twitter lynch mob, the life cycle of a troll, this kind of thing, and how to understand how these things work, the movers and shakers, the winners and losers in social media, how to use it, what it's for, places that are now a social media graveyard like Bebo and MySpace and all this kind of stuff. And it's a little kind of potted history and a little useful how-to guide, and it's perfect for Christmas.
Do you tell people
that if they at reply people at the front of the message, it only goes to that person and other people that follow both of them, because everyone in the media needs to learn that. It's so irritating when they say at Ollie Mann coming up on my show later, and then you're like, yeah, only I get to see that.
No, but I do say that the best way of dealing with a troll is to correct their grammar and spelling and send it back to them. With like marks on.
Right, on to the news, since that's why we're here. The Sun are going to drop their paywall, according to a report in The Guardian. Not to say that we told you that was coming, but we did. Rebecca Brooks has told staff, Friday morning this was, that the paywall is coming down on the News UK site at the end of November. But the U-turn comes at a difficult time for ad-funded news sites online. Apple recently updated iPhone user software to allow ad-blocking software for the first time. And last month, in response, basically, the German Daily Bild protested against Adblock Plus by producing a paper with all of the ads blacked out. City AM, as well, have recently blocked Adblocker users from their site. Susie, first of all, before we move on to what business model The Sun is going to find itself in now, is this the right move? If you were Rebecca Brooks, if you can imagine yourself in that situation, would you have made this decision?
If I was Rebecca Brooks, I'm not sure I would have stuck with that hairstyle, any of those clothes, or indeed I had the brass neck to go back to work at that company. But, to be honest, you have to have advertising as part of any journalism-funded business. You have to. You have, since the Daily Current was first published in a room above a pub in Fleet Street in 1702, that had news on the front page, it had adverts on the back, and there was a little message from the owner, who was a woman, by the way, publisher, who said, we are going to let people make their own mind up about the news, and we are funded by advertisers so that you know we're not funded by the government or anybody else. This is how we achieve independence. And that is the process which has always worked since then, and it does work for the internet as well, increasingly so, though there are problems. And The Sun's problem up till now has been a really small number of users for its website. Now, it has been able to get them to pay, but they're there for the bingo and the football and, to some extent, for the Page Three girls, although why you'd pay for that, I don't know, because it's free online.
Nostalgia.
Nostalgia, maybe, or just stupidity. They've had some niche users, but they have not got a news site. They do not get immense traffic. They've only got about 50,000 mobile users a day, for example, compared to about 15 million in a month for The Mirror, so which is free. So, you know, they advertising is all about numbers and how you get people in. Although they do have customers who pay, and subscribers may be more useful to advertisers than the other sort, they're also probably more likely to use ad blocking and so on and so forth. So you need to get a lot of free traffic in too. I'd be very interested to know what on earth they're going to do as a news site, because they don't have a news website at present.
And Steve, what about this issue of ad blocking? Because, yes, they go onto the free web, even with all the Murdoch money behind it, and, you know, let's say that they do succeed in their aims and they manage to equal The Mirror within, you know, a year or two, they're not necessarily going to be able to monetize it because the users are blocking the adverts.
The whole ad-blocking issue is, I think, really interesting, and I saw a great phrase the other day, I can't quite remember who said it, but someone said, look, ad-blocking's been around for ages, it's called going and making a cup of tea. And it is true. I mean, ad avoidance from a consumer is something that's baked into us and is only obviously being exacerbated now in terms of both on-demand viewing and the way we all scroll through the adverts, and obviously in terms of when you're on a website and you're getting, you know, you're seeing an advert and most of the time you click that little cross in the top right-hand corner so you can get rid of it
How difficult is that compared to downloading an app?
Right.
How much memory does that take on your device? Almost nothing, just click off it.
And so actually I think if you're a brand, you've got to say, well, do you want to be that irritant that is getting in the way of the content that someone wants to access, or can I aid that in some way? And I think there's a big difference. You know, obviously it's accepted, brands are needed to fund, you know, that is the model basically, until someone comes up with something better, with very few exceptions like The Economist and the FT, where you've got a very niche product that you can charge people for. Until someone comes up with something better, brands are going to be necessary. But what I think this really rotates around is the new models that we're starting to see evolve. So part of that is obviously native advertising in terms of brands starting to create something that's of worth to the audience. And I think actually what people like Lauren Laverne's website, The Pool, were doing, which is quite interesting, is not taking an advertising approach but taking a sponsorship approach, where they say a brand will cover a certain area. You know, Marks and Spencer's is our brand sponsor for our food section. We're not saying that we're publishing Marks and Spencer's content, we're just saying they're funding everything that's here, they're not editorially
the
influencing
problem,
what's here.
The publishers of the Daily Current would raise, as much as I'm going to right now, is that when you do that, you've got a story about M&S salt content in sandwiches, can that website cover it? Can that news outlet cover
it? Yeah, but
ditto with native advertising, although you can say that can add usability or usefulness for the end user. I think if you're writing an article, and the Telegraph does this quite a bit as well, and some of its print stuff, you're writing a lot of time about China and stuff that's sponsored by the Xinhua News Agency, people notice and people object, because the one thing they really expect from every news outlet, no matter what it is that it's fairly independent and that it's following the rough agenda of its
but I just don't think that's true. I mean look at the scandals there were last year. Was it the Telegraph over one of the banks where they were intentionally avoiding
HSBC?
Yep. Just weren't reporting on it at all because HSBC were a big funder of them.
Look how many readers they lost.
Well, we've got owners who, you know, for almost all our national papers, who've got their own agendas and make sure that there's only certain things that are or aren't talked about depending on what their commercial agenda is. And obviously the BBC bashing is potentially one of those cases in point where, is that something the public care about as much as the owners care about? So there's always going to be those frictions, aren't there? I mean ultimately the challenge for newspaper owners in terms of the world of the web is they are going to have to find a new model, because the current model just isn't going to translate across to the web, because you're competing on a much wider landscape. You're not just competing against other newspapers
anymore.
Yeah,
but you've got to have a kind of sponsorship which isn't going to influence the news content of what it is that you do, quality of that product.
Definitely agree with that.
If you can quite happily be sponsored by M&S and yet still give M&S a shoeing when they need shoeing, fine. Yeah. I think if it's a big money sponsorship thing, there's going to be, especially in the current climate, that's just not going to happen. I don't think native advertising is quite there either.
But this is why companies like BuzzFeed have the upper hand on this, isn't it? It's not just that they're the experts at creating advertorial, for want of a better phrase. It's that the audience expect it because they've grown out of that culture. So right from the beginning, that's what BuzzFeed always was. It's not what The Sun was, so it's harder, isn't it, for a heritage title to say, right, as of now, we're doing brand type.
Yeah, they still have a sort of a reputation for newsworthiness, which would clash with that. But I think as well, what Steve said earlier on, is that human beings are very adept at tuning out advertising, whether it comes in the form of radio or TV or anything else. And I see advertorials and you can spot them and you glaze over them. Also, what the thing with the ad blocking is, most of it tends to happen on desktop computers, although Apple have got this new app for the iPhone to make it more popular. Generally, people don't bother on mobiles quite so much, and mobiles is one of the biggest areas of growth for online news, so it may not have quite the same impact as it has done on desktop.
Huge take-up, though, in the months since they've introduced it.
I wouldn't bother doing it on my phone. I wouldn't either,
that's true. And actually, is the onus on the consumer to an extent? You know, probably everyone listening to this doesn't have ad blocking software because they're aware that the media can't make money if they install it. Is it up to the consumer to make that
true? I think for most consumers, I think it doesn't even occur to them. And I think really the challenge is actually on the advertisers, because ultimately, if you can produce advertising that is of worth to someone, you know, if someone's, you've got, what, 2 or 3 seconds to catch someone's attention before they go, this is irritating me, in terms of I want to get to the article I'm trying to get to. But if that advert is relevant to me, I mean, half the time, the problem with most of the ads we're served is they're just not relevant. You know, you're getting served all sorts of products and things that just aren't relevant to you as a consumer.
Well,
and
obviously, when someone else decides it is relevant, doesn't mean that you think it's relevant. No, they've just decided this is relevant according to your search history.
Exactly. And obviously, the one possibility that the internet allows is for the audience to be super served, you know, as our understanding gets deeper and deeper of what people do and don't like. So that's really the challenge for advertisers. How do I grab someone's attention and make sure that actually my ad spend is being used in a way where I am being ultra relevant to the people who I want to reach? It's the old counter argument to TV. TV, you go for mass numbers, but you're happy to say that there's going to be a lot of wastage because lots of the people you're reaching, you're not interested in, but you'll do that for the sake of the people you will reach.
Yeah, and online advertising should work better than the old display advertising in print or TV or anything else, because you can tell to the millisecond how much time someone has spent on a page, whereabouts their eye on that page went down to, how much of it they read, and where they got there from, and how they're accessing it, and how many times it's been shared, all the rest of it. You don't have that in print advertising, display advertising, traditionally. So I think, although the model needs to maybe be tweaked, I think that in time, as readership increases and people are more aware of how you can access people and really tailor adverts to them, but actually online advertising is going to be worth a lot more than it is now.
Okay, let's talk about the granddaddy of one-to-many media platforms, radio. On Thursday, we had the latest Rajars. They are the quarterly ratings for the industry. It's all done by listeners filling in diaries of what they've heard. This quarter is for spring into summer, so we've no information yet as to the return of Chris Moyles and how that's gone down, but there are still plenty of interesting findings. We asked Folder Media's Matt Deegan, friend of the show, to crunch the numbers.
Latest figures are in, and it's been good news for digital radio, now accounting for 41.9% of all radio listening, which is a pretty stonking number. Two-thirds of that is listening through DAB digital radio. Now, that's share, so that's volume of listening. When we look at reach, we find that 63% of the country listen to some form of digital radio each week. That's about 30 million people. 20 million of them are listening to DAB, 9 million are listening online, and 7.7 million are tuning into their digital TV. Overall for Radio 1, not a bad quarter. If you look at the top line figures, pretty static. If you start to dive into it, though, I think there's some potentially worrying trends for them. This quarter was their second lowest ever reach for 15 to 24 year olds, this demo that, you know, they really should be targeting. And also the Radio 1 breakfast show had its lowest ever 15 to 24 reach as well. And what Radio 1 often say is, they say, oh, don't think about the numbers, but think about the proportion of our audience that are 15 to 24. Well, it's kind of bad news for that as well, because they make up, I think, pretty much the joint lowest proportion of its total audience ever. And for the breakfast show, it's about the third lowest it's ever been proportionally. So a lot to do for 15 to 24s, I think, for Radio 1. One of the things I suggested on my blog this week is how they should use their digital platforms, particularly the success they've had on YouTube, to again really push back to the radio. I think, talking to some of the guys there, I think they see Radio 1 as a cross-media platform. But the thing their service license is pointing to mainly is that they're a radio station. But why not use YouTube more aggressively to push people back to the linear broadcast? London is such a competitive place for radio listening. Lots of radio stations, both analogue and digital. It's where the ad agencies are, so there's always a lot of people concentrating on the numbers. It's got really tight at the top. Capital, Kiss, Heart and Magic always battling out for the top spot. Today, we've got Kiss as the most listened to station, but only just 3,000 people ahead of Capital FM. If you look the other way at the volume of listening, how many hours, then it's the other way around, where Capital is the most listened to station and Kiss is number two. This time, we've got the last figures for XFM, and they had a good one, really. They were across the network up to 1,049,000, which is 104.9, their London frequency. Hello, geeks everywhere. But yes, a good book for them to finish on. I always think, is there an element that people have all the pressure taken off them if you know your station's going, which maybe is why they're relaxed and have done so well. In the rest of the country, different things in different places. In Oxfordshire, Jack FM and Jack 2 have been trying to push against Heart. It used to be called Fox FM, very strong in that area. Now there are only 4,000 listeners behind them, which is a real success for them. It'll be interesting to see what happens over the next 12 months. Also good figures for Orion in the Midlands, all their stations up quarter on quarter, and a brilliant performance by their station, the East Midlands Gem FM, up to 476,000, which pretty much is the highest it's ever been. But poor news for Key 103 in Manchester, slipping from commercial number 3 to commercial number 4, facing lots of challenges from Capital, Heart and Smooth.
Steve Ackerman, is Matt Deegan right that Radio 1 is making a mistake, putting all of its efforts into YouTube and not branding that as come and listen to us on 97 to 99 FM? Or is that outmoded thinking?
I think he's right and wrong at the same time. I think he's right in that there's some tweaking that can happen to ensure that there's a more circular journey going on for a member of the audience, and that they're starting to sample other bits of Radio 1's output and ultimately, hopefully, to listen to something. I think where he's wrong is that Radio 1, I think, is quite right in taking the approach of not seeing themselves just as a radio station anymore and trying to develop themselves really as a youth brand, because the audience they're trying to reach certainly do not view radio as their primary medium. And therefore, if Radio 1, as the BBC's entry point for young listeners to the BBC, is going to be relevant, it's got to have those presences that it's got on YouTube and on social media, and most interestingly on the iPlayer. And I've said for a long time, if you follow through the logical conclusion of BBC Three going on online, actually the BBC's most powerful youth brand is not BBC Three, it's Radio 1. And I would scrap BBC Three and brand that Radio 1 and then complete that circular journey.
And if the stations then are becoming brands rather than just radio stations, and your company something else for years has been rebranded, if you like, as a multi-platform content creation company, not as a radio indie, which is how you started out,
yeah.
Is there any room left for people listening to this who consider themselves to work in the radio industry. I own a radio station. I own a radio indie. I am a radio producer. Will that exist in 10 years' time?
It will exist in the sense of course, radio is not going away. I mean, listening is still as high as ever, whether that's on-demand listening or it's live listening. You know, people like Apple don't start getting into the sort of listening space unless they think there's money to be made or there's some traction there. But I think anybody who views himself just in the lens of a single platform creator is probably not quite understanding the way the world is evolving. You know, whether you're a TV producer, a news journalist, a radio producer, you have to have things like social media skills baked into what you do, or at least an understanding of those spaces. It doesn't mean you've got to suddenly ignore your radio skills. That can be your core competency. But the idea that all you do is make radio and the rest of the world sort of doesn't happen around you is, I think, really arcane.
And yeah, all the focus is always on sort of how radio stations should change and how the industry is changing at a dramatic pace, and very similar conversations to the one we were just having about paywalls. And yet, Susie, you look at the ratings. Radio 2 doing very well as ever. Radio 4, Radio
people,
4 Extra playing
old
like
shit. People like their radio. Yeah. It still goes on. Everyone likes radio pop. Anyone has to listen to Nick Grimshaw, who's got an amazing ability to repel audiences, but in several media. At once, like a multi-platform anti-magnet for audiences, TV and radio and everything else. It's the same as anything else. It's the same as the problems and the challenges which are facing print media. It's that you've got a series of skills and a series of abilities, all the people that work in it, and it's just a way of finding a different way to deliver it. It's because improving technology. It's no different to the challenges facing newspapers when movable type came in, or when colour printing came in, or when digitisation came in. This is just a new method of publication, and it's the same, you know, on the internet, and it's the same with radio. People are accessing radio digitally, and they're accessing it online and accessing it on iPlayer and things like that. But I don't really quite think that the BBC, any part of it, needs to have a brand of its own. I don't think that would go with a public service remit for the BBC. The BBC is the brand, you know, I don't want to get a bit W1A about it, but the BBC is the brand, and the bits of it, you know, they need to serve the public in the way they do, and Radio 1 needs to get to younger people. But I don't think it needs to be a brand per se. I think that would be jumping the big fish.
And yet Radar still measures when they're listening to FM at certain times of the day.
You're goading me, Ollie, because you know my views. I mean, you know, to me, Radar is just nonsensical. And maybe as someone who doesn't actually work at a radio station but obviously loves radio and is involved in radio, I can say that a bit easier. But it is still bonkers in this day and age that the radio industry has to wait months and months and months to get figures from months back, and the whole system is based on people putting stickers in diaries or ticking something on a screen, trying to remember what they were listening to 5 days ago at 7 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it's just nuts.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Right, let's talk telly. Vice are planning a linear broadcast channel in the UK. According to Broadcast Magazine, the plan is to partner with local broadcasters to make it happen, doubling the size of its production here in the UK. Steve, they say they're leaning towards a free-to-air solution. kind of sort of means they're going to gravitate towards Channel 4, doesn't it? I can't see who else is going to have the money or the platform to tie up with Vice.
Well, not necessarily, because couldn't they take some space on somewhere like Freeview or Freesat? I'm assuming what you're suggesting is just some programmes that would sit within Channel 4, whereas what I take from that article is them setting up their own channel.
Or a channel that's made in association with, so it becomes part of the Channel 4 portfolio. Because otherwise, isn't there a danger it just becomes a bit like current TV again? You know, it sounds like a good idea, but actually no one wants to watch that.
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of Radio 1, which is if you want to think about modern audiences and particularly young audiences, you've just got to think about that sort of circular journey they're going to go on, the fact that you're trying to touch them on every platform that they might interact on. And I mean, you know, it's quite an interesting move in the sense of young audiences are, you know, don't go to live TV as much as any of us would have done when we were a little bit younger, but it's still got a relevance and it's still there. It's a platform. So I think it's part of sort of squaring the circle for them. You know, clearly they see it as a way to eventually drive people back to the website, which is presumably where most of the money is for them.
Susie, what do you make of Vice? Because there's a lot of hype, but they've also
what
got the numbers.
Do I make of Vice in general or Vice the media outlet? Vice in general, I'm all for.
Me too. the platform Vice. Because they've got the numbers, but there seems to be a disproportionate amount of hype in relation to those numbers. I suppose what I mean by that is, and maybe it is just that I'm too old at the grand age of 34, but actually on my Facebook wall, people aren't sharing Vice links. I think you have to be 22.
Well, no, my Facebook wall, they're all sharing pictures of their children's graduation ceremonies and stuff like that.
That's a kind of Vice.
It's really quite irritating, not that much. I think the issue is not so much whether you've got the numbers, because it's quite easy to get numbers sometimes, but it's quality is one of the things that is most important. It's actually going to keep people there, and if you're going to be free to view, you're going to have some kind of advertising or some kind of funding somewhere in the business. One of the things in that article said that Vice, they've already got 30 odd TV series ready to go. Well, if they're ready to go and they've been sitting on them, then they're not very good TV series. Also, if it's going to be something that's online or something, or an actual going to a new TV channel somewhere else, then it makes me wonder how they've got so many, how they managed to spend any money on it whatsoever, or whether they're just free things that media students have knocked up and put up on YouTube or something. And frankly, whether it's going to be long enough to qualify for what you are and most people call a TV series, or whether it's going to be very short bits, you know, like the kind of internet video things that you get that are very, very short form.
But they do make documentaries, and obviously sitting on lots and lots of hours that they've already
They've proven works.
They've already produced, people are watching in significant numbers. So presumably the idea is we're already creating all this content in a number of offices around the world, and therefore, you know, there's probably content being produced in other countries that maybe UK audiences haven't seen as much. But there's a lot of content being produced, and therefore, put that on one channel, you've got, you know, you've got a schedule ready to go.
But it's also a relatively cheap way of producing TV. But there are lots of companies that do that. I mean, Barcroft Media, for example, who produces lots of stuff, tends to sell series on an ad hoc basis to something like Channel 5, you know, the girl with five heads kind of thing, documentaries. And they're perfectly useful and good, but I don't know, and they've got channels on YouTube and stuff, but I don't know they have enough for a TV channel on their own and all the logistics and stuff that would be involved in, really, to run a professional enterprise.
It's also the format point, isn't it? I mean, Armando Iannucci made the point in his McTaggart this year that, you know, Netflix have revolutionised the TV industry, so-called, by commissioning a remake of the BBC's House of Cards and doing an hour-long drama, effectively. I wonder whether, you know, Vice taking a 12-minute thing or a 75-minute documentary and then sticking that on a linear TV channel actually just doesn't play into the tried and tested ways people actually do want to consume TV, which is with recaps every 10 minutes in a format that they know at the same time every week.
I don't think you can second guess it, can you? I mean, potentially you might say, if you're Vice, would you look at potentially reversioning some of that stuff? Because obviously TV, you can sit with longer formats, whereas online, potentially some of the bits you offer, you want to offer a shorter version. And clearly, if you're then creating some sort of teaser or something for social media, you're going even smaller and shorter again. So, I mean, I wouldn't bet against them, purely because I think what they've done up until now has been incredibly impressive. And when you look at them in the sort of space of them and BuzzFeed and Mashable, you'd probably say they're currently the sort of leader. So I would say ignore them at your peril, in terms of they understand how to reach younger audiences and create current affairs or newsy related stuff that is relevant for that audience.
Yeah, I mean, that is their real achievement, isn't it? Getting young people talking about news at all. Sticking on news, BBC Newsnight, something that I imagine people of an older generation do spend a little bit longer with. A journalist working there has had his laptop confiscated by police under the Terrorism Act, and the BBC did not contest it. Susie, what's going on here? What's the story?
Well, it's kind of standard back practice. If you're a journalist in normal news coverage, that you'd have to speak to the police now and again and quite often help them with their inquiries. I had a phone call from a copper last week about a story I did years ago about someone who claimed to have been assaulted at the BBC and who had reported to the police and been unsatisfied with the way it had been handled by them and the BBC. I wrote a story about it, and because we'd used a pseudonym, because she was a sexual assault victim, the copper wanted to know who that person was in order to rule them out of the inquiries that they were also doing, and could I speak to her and all the rest of it. Because she's a victim of crime, because she'd already spoken to the police, I had absolutely no reason whatsoever not to just say, yeah, fine, here's the notebook, here's my phone number for her, these are the details. I just read it out over the phone. It's not an issue.
But that wasn't really abusing your position of trust with her. In the case of this Newsnight journalist, he's gone around speaking to people who are wannabe jihadis. And the police have said, using the Terrorism Act, we need to know who these people are.
Well, they initially would have approached that producer and said, we'd like to talk to you about this bloke called Mo, who has been in Newsnight and you've interviewed him, and he says he's a jihadi and he's in Syria. And he's not a confidential source. He's not like Ollie Mann has come up to me and said, Susie, I've got a great story here about the inner workings of LBC. Don't mention my name, but here's all the detail and here's a leaked memo. And I've gone in and published it. And then I would obviously
entirely
protect...
Entirely in her imagination, by the
I would obviously
way,
then protect your identity and say, you know, you can have my notebook over my dead body to the police officers. In this particular instance, it's someone who has committed a crime, allegedly, you know, is terrorism, who has admitted to committing that crime, who is trying to promote terrorism via propaganda via the BBC, and the police is offered to speak to him. I don't know whether they use a pseudonym or not. It wasn't a confidential source, they say. However, the BBC has stood on a principle here and said, we will not give up a notebook, just on principle. You know, it's the opposite of what the Sun did when the phone hacking investigation came along, when they threw every confidential source they had under the bus in order to try and avoid a corporate prosecution. I had all these prosecutions for paying police officials and stuff instead. Because they've then had to go and get a warrant, it's then under the Terrorism Act that they have to give over the laptop, and they don't argue it because they're happy to help police their inquiries, but they just wanted to be forced by the police, if you see what I mean. But in this particular instance, I think the BBC have been just a bit, tiny, teeny, tiny bit ridiculous. Because A, he wasn't a confidential source. He didn't speak to them in secrecy. He's not someone that you should be protecting. You know, he is a terrorist. He claims to be a terrorist. It is so easy as well to find jihadis online. I mean, they're all happy to talk to journalists. You only got to DM them. They're on half the encrypted apps like Kik and WhatsApp and things like this. If the police are really compelled to ask the BBC to do their work for them, they're being extremely lazy, because they should be on top of these guys' phones and mobile networks anyway without asking the BBC to do their work for them. And to be honest, if someone came to me and I'd spoken to a jihadi and I had no interest whatsoever in protecting him and he was potentially a threat, and MI5 said, could you tell us whether he's really this bloke from Luton that he claimed to be? I'll say, well, look, you know, here's my number and there you are. Because also, the problem is, when they seize a laptop or a notebook from a journalist, you've got a whole bunch of other information in there. And not having that would stop you doing your job on a longer-term basis with so many other stories.
But actually,
to stand on a principle, unless it's really worth it, would be futile, because they keep those laptops for a year or more.
But being the journalist who ultimately, I mean, this is how the terrorists might see it, being the journalist who gave up the source, whether or not it was officially confidential or not, is going to prevent other people coming to you, which is going to prevent the public
if
seeing
ISIS
those stories.
If ISIS take over Britain, all the journalists are dead anyway. So, really, you're not doing an awful lot by protecting him. You know, if you're protecting a secret source whose job is at risk, whose life is at risk, obviously you do that, and I would go to prison rather than give up a source in that kind of circumstance. But when that person claims to be a terrorist, is wanted by the police, I think the journalist does have some responsibility to try and help them wherever possible. If not giving them, you know, all their personal details, then certainly pointing them in the right direction, maybe. But I think it was impractical to wait for the laptop to be seized. And I hope that in the time they were waiting for that and the warrant was issued and so on, they erased everything else of any use on that laptop or copied it onto a different hard drive so they could carry on with their work.
Sticking with journalism, a quick update on the freedom of information story that we mentioned last episode. The government is holding a consultation until the end of November. The link's on our website, themediapodcast.com. And the press are starting to sing with one voice on this issue. The Guardian listed on Friday 103 front page stories from British papers that couldn't have been possible without FOI requests. I'm going to try this question again. I tried it with Maggie Brown. She'd applied for one FOI request, she said on the pod, and then not bothered to chase it up, so she was the wrong person to ask. Susie, I imagine FOI requests have been useful to you in your job.
I do them fairly regularly. They're usually not useful because the whole purpose of freedom of information laws in this country is to withhold information from people. In America, there is the similar Freedom of Information Act, and the presumption is always that everything goes online and you've got to kind of prove that it shouldn't if you want to keep it secret. In the UK, a law which was brought in by Blair, who's one of the many sins he's responsible for, the presumption was it should never be made public unless you could prove that it should. So you have to really, you know, if you want to say, for example, I would like to know what emails Michael Gove has shared with his advisors from his official email account this week, you have to voice it and word it in such a detailed and delicate way that there's no possible way they can wriggle out of it. Because if you don't actually nail down which email account and which days and which times and which officials, then, and that you're okay with redaction of names or something like that, then they'll just say, oh, we can't under this, we can't under that. Most of the time, the FOI requests that you make are denied under ridiculous exemptions that you then have to constantly argue and fight, to the point where, when you do get the story, it's completely out of date and it's no damn use anymore. As I often tell my journalism students as well, if you apply under your own name as a journalist, it takes 4 seconds for someone to Google it, find out you're a journalist, and then say, right, well, I'm not answering this question. It gets booted up to the press office, and you get the press office answer, not the FOI answer. So always try and use a pseudonym for when you're doing your FOI requests, which also upsets the FOI people, especially if they work out that that pseudonym's associated with that journalist. You have to keep changing them around.
So hold on, I'm going to give you an FOI request now to ask you how many pseudonyms you've used whilst you tried to get FOIs.
Oh, half a dozen. It's just a case of setting up an email account. It's really easy. Don't tell the government. But what really upsets me about this story is that Chris Grayling, who's in charge of all this today, has said that journalists are misusing this act in order to generate stories, and that's not what it's for. That is precisely what it's for, because journalists are normal citizens, and every citizen in this country has a right to access information about how the government is operating on its behalf. So journalists have a right to do that. All those 103 stories which The Guardian revealed were in the public interest and very important. One of them as well was a 3-year FOI battle waged by Chris Grayling when he was in opposition against the Department of Transport for his own political ends. And he's now saying that they shouldn't be doing that kind of thing, and that if you do it, you should be fined, you know, pay punitive amounts in order to access information. So this freedom of information is actually not free, and if you do get it, it's not real information. It's a crime against humanity, and it shouldn't be allowed.
Well, there you are. That's pretty clear. Steve, when you see that kind of passion coming from journalists, and we see similar passions being inflamed at the BBC about potential cutbacks there on the back of what John Whittingdale's been saying, does it seem to you, as it does to me, that actually the government is trying to get all of its bad news out of the way now, so that when it comes around to the next election, the media might be a bit soft on them again? So they're just right now just hitting the media with everything.
Well, governments always obviously are at their most powerful when they're in the early stages of a parliament rather than the latter stages. And I think this government in particular, it's the first time obviously we've had a Conservative government in a long, long time, and I think we're seeing a lot of agendas and a lot of scores being settled very quickly and things undone that they weren't so happy about that came in during the Labour years. And look, I mean, you've talked about it a lot on this podcast and in other media environments, the attacks on the BBC. I personally find it very difficult to see that in any light other than politically motivated.
And yet, probably, we will all forget about it by the next election. We'll be talking about something else. We'll be talking about whoever the current leader of the Tories is not turning up for the TV debates.
That's the fault of the fact we now spend so much time online. We've got much shorter attention spans. We click on something and we read it quickly. We see if the tweet was amusing or the Facebook share was worth resharing, and then we move on to the next thing. So we don't actually harbour a grudge in the way that we should do. And that's the one thing, actually, which the old print media does still do. Some people complain about this, but they can hold a grudge for decades. And I think that's one of the best things about them.
Yeah. As can the public with the print media. Liverpool
yes.
and the Sun, for
yes,
example.
Exactly.
Right, finally, one more press story for you. Trinity Mirror, owner of the Mirror titles, obviously, and some of the things as well, has bought out other shareholders to fully own the regional publisher Local World. And this is one of the biggies, isn't it? A huge owner of local titles, free titles, regional press, evening press, websites. According to the Press Gazette, that values Local World now at £220 million, just over double what it was worth 3 years ago. Well, they've done well, haven't they, Steve?
They have done well. I mean, especially for a local paper operation, I can only assume that that value is driven by the fact that they've managed to morph successfully online, because obviously there's very little value in local newspapers in terms of, you know, the physical papers. That's a dying medium, I think, however you view it. So they must have some decent numbers to back it up. Trinity Mirror are not stupid people, you know, so the EBITDA's clearly got to be good, and the ratio they've attached to that must be decent based on the fact that that there's a strong presence online that's working well.
But behind all that, what it means, I'm sure some of our listeners can back this up, is people, journalists, content creators, call them what you like, working for local titles, have lost their jobs. Susie, we're probably going to see more redundancies on the way as a result of this, aren't we? Even if Trinity Mirror didn't intend to do that, you're going to keep making it more efficient.
I don't think I've ever heard of a company taking over another company that didn't make redundancies, and Trinity Mirror have got redundancies on their national titles as well.
But Local World is triple the size of the next two largest regional publishers.
Yes, and Trinity Mirror have been in regional publishing for a long time, and they've had redundancies and cutbacks in there and everything else, but still got a lot of access to people. I think, on the one hand, it's a good sign, because it shows that somebody's actually prepared to invest in local newspapers. No matter what it is that they intend to do with that in the future, that's got to be something good, because lots of people think things like, you know, local newspapers are dying and there's problems and it's not going to work anymore and blah blah. But if you don't have local newspapers, you don't have local journalism, whether that's online or on radio or on TV or anything else, you're not holding your local authority and your local councils to account. And believe it or not, it's your local councils, the parish council, the town council, the county council, who have most impact on people's lives. Compared to the government, we spend so much time covering the government and their big decisions. What really matters to people is who's organising their bin collections, who's sorting out the potholes, who is arranging the care for their grandmother. This kind of thing is all done by local authorities. There are fewer and fewer people voting in local elections these days. The last election in 2010, there were more uncontested seats than ever before, so that people are just being returned to the local council seat without any argument whatsoever, as though they're just kind of ordained to be the local parish councillor. And those are the people that sort out your planning applications and your bypasses and all the kind of stuff that matters most to people. So if you can find a way to invest in local journalism, even if that means changing the method of delivery for it, or perhaps reducing some of the numbers so you're, you know, having fewer sub-editors and more reporters or something, as long as you are still getting those local stories, then it's got to be for the good, for all of us.
But the issue is, I guess, a lot of those local journalists aren't going down to the local county court.
Unfortunately, I think fewer of them are actually going out. Yeah. I was at the Kent Press Awards last year, which I started as a trainee in Kent when I was about 18, and I was very honoured to be invited to go back as a judge. And I was on a table of journalists who were at my old local paper, and they, you know, I spent my traineeship going to the parish council meetings. I spent my 21st birthday at a planning committee, because I genuinely was that kind of 21-year-old. And I, you know, knew the coppers, I knew the councillors, I knew the figures and everyone else in the street, and there was an office in the middle of the town. You could speak to people. If you made a mistake, Mrs. Miggins came in with her cat to complain to you about it. And now those journalists sit in the big office in a slightly different town, churning stuff out. They tweet and they Facebook and all this kind of stuff, and they do multi-platform stuff, but they do not go and knock on doors in the same way. They don't attend councils in the same way. They don't dig out stories. They don't know some of the people in the same way. But if you can find a way to make it work online, going back to the original thing we were talking about here, about online content, if you can find a way to make that business plan work, then journalism actually has access to more readers than ever before in human history. You should be making more money than ever before in human history. Therefore, you can get less out of each one, a penny out of each reader, but you're still making more money. And you should therefore be a stronger industry than ever, eventually, in maybe 10 or 20 years' time. We have to crack the online business content, and then local journalism, national journalism, international journalism is safe forever.
Doesn't the power of social media potentially navigate against that, in terms of that old cliche of, you know, the local, you know, a bunch of local residents being able to mobilise themselves and being able to communicate with each other in a way that, obviously, 20, 30 years ago, the only way that was going to happen was you went round in the evening and rung on everybody's doorbell to say, have you heard that this power station's going to be built locally?
Not everyone's on social media.
No, but obviously the numbers are still growing, and we've, you know, long ago broken away from the time when it was only younger audiences on on social. And I mean, you know, certainly I can think of my own local environment where issues at the local school have been driven far more by social media than they have by the local
press. But you have
press.
To know the people that are involved in that campaign in order to pick up their message, yes, wherever
yeah,
it might be.
Yeah.
If you happen to be a parent in that school who doesn't follow yeah. the PTA on Twitter or something, then you're not going to get the news. The same.
Yeah.
But you're more likely, perhaps, to follow the local news feed for the local BBC channel or for the local ITV or anything else. And if they're reporting on it, you're more likely to pick it up and then go and find the right thing. Because the thing about social media now, and online generally, is that rather, and radio even, is that rather than having blanket, you know, open broadcast of publication where you're hoping people pick it up, you're having to directly target people. You're going straight into their heads via their mobile phone when they're on the toilet last thing at night. And that you need, they need to be able to know exactly what they get. They're targeting one story out of a news outlet, not hundreds of them, and you have to be able to get them in that one particular special targeted way. So
I mean, the truth is, I think, is the middle area, isn't it? I mean, you're right in saying that social isn't as young as it used to be, Steve, and you're right, Susie, in saying it's not just really old people who read local papers anymore. There might be people who are parents and concerned at the school who would check it out, but there's somewhere in the middle. People probably just don't engage with their local media at all.
Well, local journalism feels to me like one of those sort of wordy things that everybody wants it because everyone can understand that.
But no one wants to spend the money.
But no one wants, you know, exactly, I don't know. And I literally can't think of one person I know who buys a local newspaper. And that's probably a London-centric thing. I'm sure if I, you know, maybe if I was living in a small village somewhere where that might be much more relevant, that may be true. So I'm happy to hold my hand up and say I live in a little media bubble and I may not be representative.
Well, I live in a small village in Kent now, and I don't have much access to the local newspapers because the shop is a long way away and I get my news in other ways and everything else, and I don't need it in the same way. But I think half the problem is that you don't have local communities in the way you used to. People are far more dispersed, people are far further away from their families, and they're not perhaps quite so tuned into what's happening in their street or in their village or town, whether that's the London village or somewhere else, than they used to be, because they go to work, they worry about stuff they see on Twitter, and they worry about their kids' school, and that's the end of their interest in things, because we've got this short attention span because we spent too much time online.
Well, I'd like to just put a word in for my Hertfordshire Parish newsletter that gets delivered by car to my door on a monthly basis for an absolutely brilliant value subscription of, I think, £12 a year. I inherited it when I moved into the house, and I've been too terrified to tell the old woman that I don't really want it and I'm not that interested in what's happening at the WI, but I do quite enjoy reading it.
Good boy for paying it.
It's good, yeah, and I get to find out about the local events. Apple Day the other week. Right, before we go, there is just time for our media quiz. Hooray, I'll say, as the guests look blank. This week it is entitled Vested Interests. I'll give you three opinions expressed by a company or an individual. You tell me who would say that, wouldn't they? So, Susie, I know you've only been here once before. Just the protocol is you buzz in with your name.
Right.
It seems to be a hard concept for many guests to understand. No, you just say Susie.
Oh, right.
Okay. And, Steve, what do you say?
Susie.
Perfect. We're all on the same page. Right, it's a quick fire. Buzz in with your name when you know the answer. The winner is Dr. Jekyll, and the loser hides from Ofcom. That's a terrible pun that I didn't write. Okay, here is question number one. Who would say that, wouldn't they? BBC One and BBC Two should be banned from airing international formats.
But Susie?
Yes, Susie.
ITV.
Correct. Tell us more.
Or Sky. I think they've been part of this general sort of consultation about the future of the BBC, which last time I looked had about 1,000 different independent reviews and reports and stuff going, oh, you just need one, for goodness sake, what a waste of money. And they say that the BBC shouldn't be able to buy drama series. So, for example, to buy popular American things or to buy the Voice franchise, which frankly they shouldn't have spent money on because it's a waste of time. And they should just concentrate on doing their own stuff and let ITV buy up the stuff that's commercial.
Yes, absolutely right. This is ITV in their response to a Culture, Media and Sport Committee inquiry saying BBC shouldn't buy international formats unless no one else wants them. Steve, the problem with that, obviously, is you're kind of condemning the BBC to air only unpopular stuff. And some of the formats we think of as uniquely BBC, like Dragon's Den and The Apprentice, are international formats done in a very BBC way.
Yeah, absolutely right. And obviously, you're also, you know, you could argue for content creators, you're distorting the market because what you're basically saying is, ITV, you're the most powerful commercial player. You have your pick of what you want. Name your price. Mm. And that's obviously going to be a low price because don't worry, anyone else who's got money isn't going to compete with you.
All right, here's number two. Which vested interest said this? BBC Worldwide shouldn't be privatised. Buzz in when you know the answer.
I have no idea.
Well, it must be the BBC. Channel 4?
Name, say your name.
Susie.
Yes.
Channel 4.
Yes.
I don't know why, though. I only just said that because you said 4 at me.
I was miming the number 4 at you. But don't say that, because now you've made it obvious I've engineered the result. We're now going to have a deadline anyway.
Well, I'm going to put in an official judge's complaint. The fact you were miming it to Susie and not to me. So
we need to have an Ofcom review of the whole thing.
Yes, this is the view of Channel 4 also being considered by the government for a sell-off. And here we are. We're at deadlock, even though Susie's won, because clearly I rigged it. So, Steve, it's all to play for.
I'm not going to be offended in any way at all.
Here's vested interest. Question number 3. The campaign against my colleague Seamus Milne is deeply unfair. Which vested interest said that?
Well, it must be someone from the Guardian.
With your name.
Susie.
No. Steve said it first. Steve, say Steve.
Steve.
Right.
Steve. Steve, Susie. I'm covering all bases. Well, it must be the Guardian, but I have no idea who at the Guardian.
Yes, it was Guardian columnist Owen Jones said it. Of course, Seamus Milne has gone on temporary leave to head up Labour's comms team. Susie, what do you make of that appointment, by the way?
Well, if they want to appoint someone from a newspaper to operate as a comms team, that's probably a good idea. They've certainly done it in the past.
Worked for Alistair Campbell,
didn't it? Worked, well, you know, Tom Baldwin's been there for the Tories and Alistair Campbell's been there for Labour. That's fair enough. What I object to on a massive scale is the fact that he's on leave from The Guardian to do this. Now, that effectively means that The Guardian is in the government's pocket. In Labour Party's pocket.
Does it?
Yes.
Why?
Yes,
because it will toe the line. It means that he's still an employee, number one. When any journalist stops being objective at all, then they are not a journalist anymore. If you take an honour from the government of the day, if you work for that one particular political party, you have to stop being a journalist. You are not a journalist.
He'll go back to the
anymore.
Guardian, won't he, when Jeremy Corbyn is unsuccessful
in
the general election?
Resign and
then
go. But to keep hold of your job, now I don't know what the pay arrangements are or anything else, but to keep hold of your job effectively means that that paper is saying it supports that party leader and that political viewpoint.
But the Guardian is a Labour supporting paper. There's
people
no
say that about
there.
The Mirror, but they still criticise Gordon Brown, and they say that
one
Daily
journalist.
Mail is a Tory party, but they still criticise Cameron.
I don't quite understand the controversy. I mean, I didn't know he was on leave, but when you say the minute a journalist stops being objective, they're not a journalist. I mean, there's huge swathes of journalists, so you can't claim they're objective in any way at all. There's nothing wrong with that. They sort of work for a newspaper that has a particular left or right
objectivity
bias.
Objectivity is a perception, though. Yeah, and if you work for... I've worked for The Mail, and I've worked for The Guardian, and I've worked for The Sun, and every time I've worked for a different paper, I get accused of towing that paper's line because you happen to write a particular story for them. That doesn't mean you've lost your objectivity.
What about Andrew Pearce? His handle on Twitter is @ToryBoyPearce. He's quite open about the fact that he's a Conservative supporter.
It's slightly different.
He's got a senior
opinion.
Position at The Mail, hasn't he?
I think if you're especially if you're a reporter, generally, you have to be objective.
Okay.
It's not quite the same. We have Ofcom rules. But I'm disgusted as a journalist that someone who is a journalist and is now working for a political party thinks they can still be a journalist. You can't. It doesn't matter what party it is that you're doing it for.
I don't quite understand the idea of sort of keeping his job open in the sense of, well, surely he could have left and then when he's finished doing his job for the Labour Party, he goes back. I mean, I'm not quite sure.
It's a bit of a ridiculous editorial decision by The Guardian.
I'm going to make a ridiculous editorial decision now and end this podcast, even though this is very entertaining to listen to, and it's been so long that
Bring
I've actually
the
forgotten who won the quiz,
Milne.
Which is just as well.
I won the quiz.
Yeah, I declare Steve the winner. Thank you to Steve Ackerman. Thank you to Susie Boniface. Thank you very much. You can find all of our previous instalments and get new ones downloaded automatically straight to your phone. Just head to themediapodcast.com. And today's show is dedicated to the following fantastic people who made it happen. Thank you very much. Andrew Winter, development telenerd Sam Shatabi, Tom Blakeson, Martin Clench, and Mark Gannon, who included with his donation the note that he is, quote, more than happy to pay to keep creativity free. That all sounds very noble. If you'd just like to give us some money and get your name on the show, then please do help us. It's how we keep this show running. themediapodcast.com/dedicate. And there's a whole range of options there now. Thank you for those of you who suggested on Twitter we should provide them. We have. You can now submit your sponsorship at various different levels. And thank you very much for the cold hard cash as well as your ears. I've been Ollie Mann. The producer is Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hold up.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.